Blog Talk Radio.
Okay.
To the Bard's Grove tonight.
Shining on.
And I hear we have Lil with us again tonight.
That's right.
Hi, Lil.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm terrific, thank you.
So, Kat, what's up in the sky tonight?
Well, we are in the dark. Part of the Earth cycle. We're in the Scorpio cycle, and so it's about death. It's about letting go of the old so that in the proper time, the new can be born. So it's really interesting. I've been talking with a lot of people. People are tired. That usually happens at the change of a season. We're going to have the clocks change again on Saturday night. Sunday morning, so in autumn we fall back, right?
Right.
So people will tend to be tired. They'll tend to maybe catch a little cold. So it's a good time to take care of your kidneys because this is the kidney season in Qigong, in the Eastern medicine. So, you know, lots of different things going on. As we begin this storytelling hour, I have to say something about a movie, a marvelous movie I saw that is very much about what we're talking about now, about death and about transformation, because that's what Scorpio is. Scorpio isn't just, okay, it's about death, so die and then it's all over, or that you go to hell or the demons will get you, which is some of the stories we'll read about, you know, we'll be talking about probably tonight. But it's a chance for rebirth. And the movie that I'm talking about is called The Way. Have either of you seen it yet?
No, I haven't.
It's a marvelous movie. It's by Emilio Estevan, and Martin Sheen, his father, is in the movie. This is Martin Sheen's son, who didn't take the name Sheen, but kept the family name of Estevan. And we probably remember him as an actor. I think he was in, like, maybe The Breakfast Club or something like that back when my children were teenagers. But he wrote and directed this movie. And what it is, it's a story about a father, you know, who's a doctor, and his 40-year-old son who he has trouble with because the son has quit his job and he travels. That's all he does is he travels. And the son goes off traveling and what he's doing is he's going to go on the Camino Royale. He's going to go on pilgrimage to St. James de Compostela in the Pyrenees. And the story is about how he dies on the first night because of weather, because you're alone on these in these mountains. And when the father goes to get his body, he decides to walk on the way. And so the father does the pilgrimage. And it is beautifully written, like a fairy tale. This man attracts his little helpers, or not. But he attracts, you know, different people on the road. And it is marvelous. It's one of the best movies I've seen in very many years.
Cool.
Yeah. So I recommend it to everyone, The Way. It's probably a little independent film. It's probably not a big Hollywood film, but it certainly deserves everybody's attention. And it certainly is about these themes of going into death. What happens? So many people in our culture fear death, and that's probably why we have, you know, we're in the trouble we're in, because people don't want to let go so something new can come. And I hear, Lantern, that you're going to tell us a story later on about Ulysses in the underworld. Is that true?
That's correct. His story about his trip to Hades.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, back then in ancient Greece, the gods didn't want their children to take over. So we have the story of Uranus stuffing his children into Mother Earth and never letting them get born. And then Saturn or Cronus, he takes over and he swallows his children because he doesn't want anyone else to take over. So there's, you know, there's a certain theme about a fear of death, as if death is evil. And Scorpio is the time to face those fears. So anyway, I'm going to tell a story from a book called Lilith's Cave, Jewish Tales of the Supernatural.
Wow.
Collected and retold by Howard Schwartz. And, you know, each religion has different ideas about death. The Western religions definitely think that when you're gone, you either go to hell or heaven or purgatory. The Eastern religions say that we get born again. They're more feminine, if you will. They're more in tune with the cycles of the earth. And so the stories that come, the little, you know, fairy tale, apocryphal stories, whatever, that come from the different religions, reflect these beliefs. So this is the story. It's called Rabbi Lowe and the Angel of Death. One night, not long before the holy days were to begin, Rabbi Lowe glimpsed a light in the synagogue across the way, and he wondered who might be in there at that hour. He left his house, and as he approached the synagogue, he saw through the window a strange figure standing at the pulpit. The closer Rabbi Lowe came, the more sinister did the figure seem, and suddenly Rabbi Lowe realized who it was. The Angel of Death. And at the same time, he came close enough to see the angel sharpening a knife over a long scroll on which many names were written. Rabbi Lowe was pierced with terror and resisted a powerful impulse to run away. But a moment later, he became calm and self-possessed, and he knew what he had to do. As silently as possible, he opened the door of the synagogue and came up behind that dread angel. All at once, he snatched the long list out of the angel's hands, tearing it away from him, and he ran from the synagogue to his home, where he threw the list into the flames and watched until every scrap of it was burnt to ashes. Well, now the plague had begun to spread in the city, and that was the list of victims the Angel of Death had come to take in one fell swoop. Now, only those on the piece of the list left in his hand fell victim to him. All the rest were spared. But among those on the list was Rabbi Lowe, and it was he, above all, that the deadly angel was determined to capture. Rabbi Lowe, who could read the lines of the future, knew that the angel would try to snatch him to seek revenge. But the rabbi used his powers to avoid the angel, much as King David had done, by studying the Torah day and night. The angel of death is forbidden to take a man while he is engaged in the study of the Torah. Yet even so, the angel found a ruse by which to capture him. He hid in a rose of great beauty that grew in the garden of Rabbi Lowe's grandson. One day, this little boy plucked the rose as a gift to his grandfather, and as he held it in his hand to present it to the rabbi, Rabbi Lowe perceived the presence of the dark angel hidden in the rose. Then he did not hesitate, but accepted the gift from his grandson, for he knew that if he did not, the boy's life would be endangered. And no sooner did Rabbi Lowe take in his hand that rose than the angel of death struck him like a serpent and snatched his soul. That was an 19th century story from Eastern Europe called Rabbi Lowe and the Angel of Death.
Wow, that was a good one.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's so many stories about how do we put off death and what will we allow and when will we allow death in? And certainly, as any parent knows, they would rather die than have their child die. And so it was a very tricky move on the Angel of Death's part, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Lil or Lantern, who's going to tell another story?
Well, I think Lil's got a little morsel for us next. Lil?
I do, and it's really thank you. It's very interesting that you would choose a story from the Hebrew Bible, because I've done the same thing. It's not only do serpents tend to represent in cultures as diverse as Samaria and India and Mexico, death, but also it's used as a time of having an inner death to encourage us to tame our inner demons. And one of those legends was unearthed from the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it's in an inscription that's now referred to as the Testament of Amran. And I'll read you just this tiny bit of it. I saw watchers in my vision, the dream vision. Two men were fighting over me. I asked them, "Who are you, that you are thus empowered over me?" They answered me, "We have been empowered to rule over all mankind." They said to me, "Which of us do you choose to rule you?" I raised my eyes and looked. One of them was terrifying in his appearance, like a serpent, his cloak many-colored yet very dark. And I looked again, and in his appearance, his visage like a viper. I replied to him, "This watcher, who is he?" He answered me, "This watcher and his three names are Belial and Prince of Darkness and King of Evil." Well, Amran was none other than the father of Moses. And in a similar vein, the Hindu god Vishnu is often depicted as standing on a thousand-headed snake named Shishanag, I believe, and the snake stands with its hood open over the head of the Lord, having been tamed by Vishnu. Symbolically, the snake denotes that the mind and the thousand heads of the snake signify innumerable desires and passion of an individual. Just as a snake destroys its victim by its venom, an uncontrolled mind destroys the world by the venom of its possessiveness. The Lord has controlled all desires, and this is symbolized by his showing, by showing him seated on the two coils of the snake. And so when a sincere devotee to Lord Shiva controls his desires, the Lord is still said to fulfill his genuine desire and help him on his path. And that's just a little history of some of the ways that we perceive death and rebirth on an inner level.
Fantastic.
Super, super. I think you have another special one for us, don't you, Kat?
Well, you know me. I always have stories. You don't have a story to tell yet?
Well, I do. I can tell a nice little shorty before I get into that longer piece.
Why don't we do that, Lantern?
Okay. This is an ancient legend called Janáček's Fist. And it has to do with life and death, and it has to do with an appreciation of meeting out death, even to one's enemies, with a certain degree of compassion and judiciousness. So this is the story of the legend of Janáček's Fist. Traveling from Rumzumbrok, nearby Lidkoska's cave, you can spot a big limestone boulder, shaped very much like a clenched fist. It's called Janáček's Fist. And many legends are told about this boulder. One of them dates to the times when Janáček and his fellow friends were living in the region as brigands. It happened a long time ago on a beautiful sunlit autumn morning. Dirko Janáček was traveling with his group from Moravsky Porovnia to Karovka Hofka Mountain. It was very soon in the morning. You would not even see the red twilight sky yet. Nevertheless, they were already going along the Lekava castle up to the peak of the Minich mountain. Suddenly, they heard a sharp, loud whistle coming from the forest. Immediately, they understood the message. It was a warning sent by their fellow outlaws. Janáček and his friends passed carefully to the slope. After a while, they spotted a carriage going along the road, meandering through the countryside below. Two nobles were sitting on the carriage, accompanied by a group of horsemen. When the carriage came closer, the boys were pleasantly surprised to discover that it was the Baron Reve in person. He was accompanied by his adjutant and protected by about 15 armed catchpoles. The catchpoles looked also familiar to them, as they had already had the opportunity to meet them not only once. The Baron was widely known as a ruthless tyrant who had shown no mercy to the common people. Janáček ordered Rovka, Juráček, stop the carriage. The rest with me. Let them take arms and rope them. I don't want anyone killed. Shouting, they ran out of the forest to group round the armed men. And until that moment, the Baron was feeling perfectly safe. Réveil and his adjutant didn't get immediately clear on what was happening. And when they found out, they were already roped. Janáček was looking at the battle, and when he saw sabers in the hands of Réveil's men, he dashed into it. Under his steel fist, the catchpoles were falling like dummies. Janáček didn't like needless bloodshedding, so he was pleased that the attack had been completely successful. No one was harmed. He asked the Baron, who by now was scared to death, "Do you recognize me, Réveil?" "Arrogant as always," the Duke answered. "Of course I recognize you, you dirty peasant. You're going to regret this." Janáček coolly replied, "Your Grace, you are the reason that I do what I do, and I am proud to be born a peasant. Because without hard-working peasants, people like you wouldn't have any fortune and would be dying by starvation. And now, to remember better this day, how about if you try a little bit of what you give to your people?" They took him to the foot of a hill situated above the road. They stretched him on a tree stump, holding his hands and legs. Rovka gave him 25 strokes of the cane. Already unconscious, they took him to the carriage, revived him with cold water. Janáček said, "Now you go back to the place you're coming from. I'm aware you're hurrying to the Squire Convention that should be held on Mikulas' country. But don't worry. St. Sophia's castle will be your harbor until your people from the castle in the Povze region will come to pick you up." Horovna said to Janáček, "Captain, today has been a great day. You've prevented the needless bloodshed. You protected our lives, but punished Réveil as he deserves. We will never forget it. We have decided to carve a big fist in this stone, as it has been witness of your heroic action. The boulder will stay here as a symbol of your great strength and courage." And that's the story of the big stony fist lying under Minich Mountain. The boulder was giving jitters to cruel nobles for many and many a year, and today it remains even now, reminding us of the legendary hero, Juraj Janáček, the hero who represented the poor. The story of Juraj Janáček and the Stone Fist.
Okay. We like these heroes. We like these heroes.
Well, I think even times like today, we need heroes who stand up to those who would treat working people cruelly.
Well, I think we are. I think we're seeing it in the Occupy movement. I think we're seeing it in a lot of places.
I'm liking what I'm seeing of the Occupy Marines movement, standing up for the people who are being physically abused in these protests unnecessarily.
Yes.
Those are the kind of heroes I really like seeing.
Absolutely.
Yes, most Absolutely. Definitely. This is a time for heroes again.
It is.
It's quite exciting.
Lil, do you have another shorty for us?
Well, I have another one that I can pull out of my head. It's not in front of me. This is a Down Under story. And it's about surviving death. Now, there was a big, great big flood, and this is at a time before there were people. And there were just the tribes of the animals. And all the animals were gathered on a mountaintop, high, 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 but they were all very afraid because the world had been covered with water and the waters were still rising. And so the council of the elders got together and from all the different animal tribes and decided they were going to send one animal out from each of the tribes to try to find dry land so they could be safe because clearly they were going to be overcome by water. So they decided to start with the snake because the snakes were thought to be the wisest. So they sent a snake out, and they gave him a light to hold up. And he held, and he swam, and he held that light, and he swam. And he got far, far out there, and the light became very, very dim, and suddenly it disappeared, and he had drowned. So they gathered together and decided what animal to send next, and they sent that animal, and he swam, and he swam, and he swam, and he swam, and the light got smaller and smaller, and again, the light went out, and he drowned. And they went through all the animals until they got to one last one, and that was the wing-necked lizard. And this little lizard was very, very slovenly. He just rested all the time. They even had to wake him up and say, "It's your turn, it's your turn to try to go and save all of us." And he said, "Okay, I'll go." And he said, "Get, you know, out there, and if you can find land, take this light and light a big signal fire so we'll all know where to go." And he said, "All right, but I want this light to be made from one particular tree." And they thought he was very silly, and they said, "Oh, but, you know, whatever." Okay, they laughed at him, but they gave him what he wanted. And he went on his way, and he swam, and he swam, and he swam. And that light stayed on, and he kept swimming and swimming and swimming and swimming. Finally, everybody grew very, very, very tired, and they all went to sleep. And lo and behold, when they woke up in the morning, there was an enormous signal fire on the distant horizon because he'd found land. And they were all saved. So they all jumped in the water and they swam to that fire and they had this big feast. And this little lizard just sat around very quietly and very slovenly like he was, very still. Now the elders had promised that whoever was able to find land and save all the animal people would be revered as the highest among all the animal people for all time. And so they gave him that honor. So from time to time, even today, you'll see that wing-necked lizard standing up, very proud, head way up in the air, tilted back, reminding us of how he saved the people. And in that stance, you can see in the center of his chest where that light burned so long and so dark and so dumb that it actually burned his chest before he was able to find his way.
Very nice.
Yes.
Very nice. Yes.
Bravery and facing death all at once.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
Well, Kat, do you have a little something else you want to share?
Yes, I do.
Fantastic.
I sort of found... This week was interesting, the themes, because I pulled out some stories from both the Muslim and the Jewish tradition. This story is from a book called The Caravan of Dreams by Indra Shaw. I think I must have had this back in the 70s. It's one of the old books. But anyway, this story is called Cheating Death. Once upon a time, there was a man called Omar, who was a most wealthy merchant. He had a fleet of fine ships. He brought merchandise from far lands. His line was noble, his honor unsullied. Well, one day, his good fortune deserted him. News came that in a fierce storm, all of his ships had been wrecked. His sailors had drowned to a man. "Allah, have mercy upon me," cried Omar. "Surely this is the worst day of my life." But more was to come. Upon returning to his house, he found that it had burned to the ground, his stock of silks and jewels gone, his gold taken by thieves. The servants, unable to face him, had all run away. So he was alone, no money, no home, no personal possessions. "Without my treasures, I'm finished," he thought. "I cannot bear to hold up my head among those who respected me for my wealth and position. How, in my agony, can I start again? It's impossible." And so he decided to take his courage in his hands and cast himself from a high rock into the sea. The angry waters closed over his head, and he fell as if into a bottomless pit. But the sea, after half drowning him, cast him up on the sand. There he lay, blinking up at the sun in torn and filthy clothes, unable to believe he was still alive. "I only want to die," he cried to the unheeding sky. "I can no longer live." He picked himself up and staggered through the rocks upon the beach, thinking of all the ways that he could take his life. In the streets of the town where he wandered, half crazed with despair, no one knew him for the once great merchant he used to be. He was jostled, pushed out of the way, and shouted out by little boys. Suddenly, though, there was an outcry. "Death to all kings and rulers!" Omar heard a voice, the voice of a mad, ragged beggar who was brandishing a knife. He stopped to see what was happening. It was at the gate of the royal palace where the captain of the guard lay dead, slain by the madman. The soldiers seemed powerless to stop the huge beggar, and Omar ran swiftly to help the king as the shining blade rose again in the insane beggar's hand. Without fear, Omar grappled with the man, and they rolled over and over on the marble floor. The guards rushed into the throne room and severed the madman's head from his shoulders. "Stop," said the king, as Omar tried to run away, bent on finding some other way to bring about his own destruction. "Come here, my good fellow, for I must reward you for saving my life." "Your Majesty," said Omar, "I wish for no reward. I only wish to die." "Die," said the king, "why should you die? Now tell me all, omit no detail." "Well, my ships have all been wrecked, my house burned, my gold stolen by thieves. I can no longer hold up my head among my associates. Therefore, I must find the quickest way to leave this unhappy world. Even the sea refused to drown me." "Foolish man," said the king, "for saving my life, you shall benefit. Is it not forbidden to commit the great sin of taking one's own life? Come, you shall regain all that you have lost and become once more high in the land." The king gave instructions to his grand vizier then that Omar was to receive a robe of honor, new ships were to be fitted out for him regardless of cost, and all his gold restored from the royal treasury. Sounds like a bank, doesn't it? Anyway, from that hour, Omar became once more respected and honored and lost the desire to die. In time, he became so wealthy he was able to ask for the king's daughter in marriage, and he amassed a vast fortune in fabulous merchandise. One day he was walking in his rose garden smelling one particularly beautiful bloom when he heard a voice calling his name. He turned and saw a tall figure with covered face and folded hands standing under a tree. "Peace be upon you," said Omar. "Whom have I the pleasure of greeting?" "I am the angel of death," said the shrouded figure, "and I have come to take you to paradise. You must come with me now." "Oh, no, no, I cannot come with you," said Omar. "I'm not ready to go now. I have a fine, rich life, everything I need. The king's daughter is my wife. Please spare me. Let me enjoy the good things of this wonderful world a little longer." "You must come with me," said the angel of death. I have my duty, just like everyone else. Come, I must be off to take the call to other men as well." Then Omar thought of a crafty plan. I'm not prepared. Let me go to the mosque and say my prayers, and then I will come with you willingly." "After you have said your prayers, you will come with me, you promise?" asked the angel. "Yes, I promise," said Omar, and bent his head to hide a smile. Well, the angel vanished, and Omar laughed aloud. And from that day, Omar never went near the mosque.
Yeah.
Years passed, and Omar became more and more important. When his first gray hairs had come, he peered at himself in a looking glass and thought, "How distinguished I've become. Surely I am the most important person in the land after my respected father-in-law, the king." A servant entered at that moment to say that the king requested Omar's presence at court before the hour was gone. So Omar hastened to listen to what the king had to say. my dear Omar, the religious teacher of the Turquoise Mosque, has died, and I can think of no one more suitable than yourself to take his place. Come, let us go together, this being Friday, and you will lead the prayer at midday. No, Your Majesty, Omar said. No, I'm not worthy. Please choose someone else. Someone, anyone but me. Your modesty does you credit, said the king, but I am now even more decided it should be you. Let us hurry, for it is nearly 12. Attended by the courtiers, the king and Omar walked towards the Turquoise Mosque. Although the sun burned hot overhead, Omar felt as if an icy hand clutched at his heart. His pride left him, and he knew that the angel of death was not far away. They reached the mosque, and Omar led the congregation in prayer. As the faithful bent their knees and rose and knelt again, Omar prayed more fervently to Allah than he had ever done before. He beseeched the Almighty to forgive his great sins in life and have compassion. After a few moments, the angel of death with covered head and folded hands appeared to Omar, unseen by the rest. Come with me now, said the angel. I've waited a long time for you, and this is your day of reckoning. All at once, Omar felt a great peace within his heart. He inclined his head. Very well. It's a great relief, after all, to see you at last. I'll go with you. Paradise, after all, is the just reward for all true believers after this life on earth. No, not so, said the angel. I'm not here to take you to paradise. I came before to do so, but you tricked me, remember? And now you are to be punished. You are to be sent to the lower regions, for you've had your paradise on earth. Before Omar could utter a cry, the angel of death embraced him in his chilly arms and bore him away, leaving upon the marble floor a lifeless figure, clad in a priceless robe, kneeling as if in prayer. And that's the story of cheating death.
Wow, very good.
Yeah, very good. You can't cheat death. Most definitely not.
No. Isn't it interesting how unlimited his determination was when he didn't have anything to lose, to risk his life?
Yes. Yes, he was ready to throw it away, and yet, you know, you have to begin to wonder, you know, he was going to go to paradise after trying to kill himself. But after being haughty, he was going to the lower regions. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Very nice.
Teach us.
Yes, nice. They do. You know, there's another legend from Australia, which is where the legend that I told was from Australia just now. And I shouldn't say it's a legend, it's a way of being with the Aborigines, or at least some of the tribes. Suicide isn't considered a bad thing to do. It's considered actually a compassionate thing to do. When you are tired and weary, it's perfectly okay, and when you become a burden, you can go ahead and just sit out and wait for your time in a cave, and nobody think anything lesser of you for it.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, look at this story of Socrates. He killed himself when it was time. And so much as of our perception about life and death is configured by our religious background and our religious beliefs. And it's really, it would be really interesting if we could step outside the whole thing and just experience what the earth wants to tell us about life and death rather than the church or the synagogue.
Well, I've got a story of what Homer has to say about a visit to Hades.
Oh, no good.
Here we go. This is Homer's telling of the descent into hell, chapter 11 of the Iliad. Ulysses continues his narration, how he arrived at the land of the Cimmerians, what ceremonies he performed to invoke the dead, the manner of his descent, the apparition of the shades, his conversations with Elpenor and with Tiresias, who informs him in a prophetic manner of his fortunes to come. He meets his mother, Anticles, from whom he learns the state of his family he sees the shades of the ancient heroines, afterwards of the heroes, and converses in particular with Agamemnon and Achilles. Ajax keeps at a sullen distance and disdains to answer him. He then beholds Tydeus, Tantalus, Sisyphus, and Hercules till he's deterred from further curiosity by the apparition of horrid specters and the cries of the wicked in torment. Now to the shore we bend, a mournful train. Climb the tall bark and launch into the main. At once the mast we rear, at once unbind the spacious sheet and stretch it to the wind. The pale and pensive stand with cares oppressed, and solemn horror saddens every breast. A freshened breeze the magic power supplied, while the winged vessel flew along the tide. Our oars we shipped, all day the swelling sails, full from the guiding pilot catch the gales. Now sunk the sun from his aerial height, and o'er the shaded billows rushed the night. When lo, we reached old ocean's utmost bounds, where rocks control his waves with even-during mounds. There, in a lonely land and gloomy cells, the dusky nation of Cimmeria dwells. The sun ne'er views the uncomfortable seats, when radiant he advances or retreats. Unhappy race, whose endless night invades clouds the dull air and wraps them round in shades. We ship, we moor on these obscure abodes, disbark the sheep, an offering to the gods, and hellward bending, o'er the beach decry the doleful passage to the infernal sky. The victims vow to each Tartarian power, Eurylochus and Perimedes bore. Here oped hell, all hell I here implored, and from the scabbard drew the shining sword, entrenching the black earth on every side, a cavern formed a cubit long and wide. New wine, with honey-tempered milk we bring, and living waters from the crystal springs. O'er these was strewn the consecrated flower, and on the surface shone the holy store. Now the wan shades we hail, the infernal gods, to speed our course and waft us o'er the floods. So shall a barren heifer from the stall beneath the knife upon your altars fall. So in our palace, at our safe retreat, rich with unnumbered gifts the pile shall burn. So shall a ram, the largest of the breed, black as these regions, to Tereus bleed. Thus solemn rites and holy vows we paid to all the phantom nations of the dead. Then died the sheep, a purple torrent flowed, and all the cavern smoked with steaming blood, when lo appeared along the dusty coasts thin, airy shoals of visionary ghosts. Fair, pensive youths, and soft enamored maids, and withered elders, pale and wrinkled shades, ghastly, with wounds the form of warriors slain, stalked with majestic port a martial train. These and a thousand more swarmed o'er the ground, and all the dire assemble shrieked round. Astonished at the sight, aghast I stood, and a cold fear ran shivering through my blood. Straight I command the sacrifice to haste, straight the flayed victims to the flame are cast, and muttered vows and mystic song applied to grisly Pluto and his gloomy bride. Now swift I wave my falchion o'er the blood. Back started the pale throngs and trembling stood. Round the black trench the gore untasted flows, till awful from the shades Tereus rose. There, wandering through the gloom I first surveyed, new to the realms of death Elpenor's shade, his cold remains all naked to the sky, on distant shores unwept, unburied lie. Sad at the sight I stand, deep fixed in woe, and ere I spoke, the tears began to flow. Oh, say what angry power Elpenor led, to glide in shades and wandered with the dead? How could thy soul by realm and seas disjoined, outfly the nimble sail and leave the lagging wind? The ghost replied, to hell my doom I owe, demons accursed, dire ministers of woe. My feet, through wine unfaithful to their weight, betrayed me stumbling from a towery height. Staggering I reeled,
and as I reeled I fell. Luxed the neck joint, my soul descends to hell. But lay me aid, I now conjure thee lend, by the soft tie and sacred name of friend, by thou fond consort, by thy father's cares, by loved Telemachus, blooming years. For well I know that soon the heavenly powers will give thee back today and Circe's shores. There, pious, on my cold remains attend, there call to mind thy poor departed friend. The tribute of a tear is all I crave, and the possession of a peaceful grave. But if, unheard, in vain compassion pled, revere the gods avenge the dead. A tomb along the watery margin raise, the tomb with manly arms and trophies grace, to show posterity Elpenor was. There, high in air, memorial of my name, fix the smooth oar and bid me live to fame. To whom with tears these rites, O mournful shade, due to thy ghost, shall to thy ghost be paid. Still as I spoke, the phantom seemed to moan, tear followed tear, and groan succeeded groan. But as my waving sword the blood surrounds, the shade withdrew and muttered empty sounds. There, as the wondrous vision I surveyed, all pale ascends my royal mother's shade. A queen, to Troy she saw our legions pass, now a thin form is all Anticlus was. Struck at the sight, I melt with filial woe, and down my cheek the pious sorrows flow. Yet as I shook my falchion o'er the blood, regardless of her son, the parent stood. When lo, the mighty Theban I behold, to guide his steps he bore a staff of gold. Awful he trod, majestic was his look, and from his holy lips these accents broke. Why, mortal, wanderest thou from cheerful sky to dread the downward melancholy way? What angry gods to these dark regions led thee, yet alive, companion of the dead? But sheathe thy poniard while my tongue relates heaven's steadfast purpose and thy future fates. When yet he spoke, the prophet I obeyed, and in the scabbard plunged the glittering blade. Eager he quaffed the gore, and then expressed dark things to come, the counsels of his breast. Weary of light, Ulysses here explores a prosperous voyage to his native shores. But know by me, unerring fates disclose new trains of danger and new scenes of woes. I see thy bark by Neptune tossed, for injured Cyclops and his eyeball lost. Yet to thy woes the gods decree an end, if heaven thou please, and how to please attend. Whereon to Creon rocks the ocean roars, gaze numerous herds along the verdant shores. Though hanger press, yet fly the dangerous prey, the herds are sacred to the god of day, who all surveys with his extensive eye, above, below, on earth and in the sky. Rob not the god, and so propitiate gales, attend thy voyage, impel thy sails. But if his herds ye seize beneath the waves, I see thy friends o'erwhelmed in liquid graves. Dryful wreck, Ulysses scarce survives, Ulysses at his country scarce arrives. Strangers thy guides, nor there thy labors end, new foes arise, domestic ills attend. These foul adulterers to thy bride resort, and lordly gluttons riot in thy court. But vengeance hastes amain, These eyes behold the deadful scene, prince on prince rolled. That done, a people far from sea explore, who ne'er knew salt, nor heard the billows roar, or saw gay vessel, a Tem the watery plain, a painted wonder, flying on the main. Near thy back an oar, with strange amaze, a shepherd meeting thee, thy oar surveys. And names of Van, there fixed on the plain, to calm the gods that hold the watery rain. A threefold offering to his altar bring, a bull, a ram, a boar, and hail the ocean king. But home returned to each ethereal power, slay the due victim in the genial hour. So peaceful shalt thou end thy blissful days, and steal thyself from life by slow decays. Unknown to pain, in age resign thy breath, when late stern Neptune points the shaft with death. To the dark grave retiring, as to rest, the people blessing by thy people blessed. Unerring truths, O man, my lips relate. This is thy life to come. This is my fate. To whom unmoved, if this the gods prepare, what heavens ordain the wise with courage bear? But say, why yonder on that lonely strand, unmindful of her son, Anticlus stands? Why to the ground she bends her downcast eye? Why is she silent while her son is nigh? The latent cause, O sacred seal, reveal. Nor this, replies the seer, will I conceal. Know to the spectres that thy beverage taste, the scenes of life recur, and actions past, they, sealed with truth, return the sure reply. The rest repel, a train oblivious fly. The phantom prophet ceased, and sunk from sight to the black palace of eternal night. Still in the dark abodes of death I stood, and near Anticlus moved, and drank the blood. Straight all the mother in her soul awakes, and owning her Ulysses thus she speaks, "Comest thou, my son, alive to realms beneath, the dolesome realms of darkness and of death? Comest thou alive from pure ethereal day? Dire is the region, dismal is the way. Here lakes profound, where floods oppose their waves. Here the wide sea with all his billow raves. Or, since to dust proud Troy submits her towers, comest thou a wanderer from the Phrygian shores? Or say, since honor called thee to the field, hast thou thy Ithaca, thy bride beheld? Source of my life, I cried, from earth I fly to seek Tereus in the nether sky, to learn my doom, for tossed from woe to woe, in every land Ulysses finds a foe. Nor have these eyes beheld my native shores, since in the dust proud Troy submits her towers. But when thy soul from her sweet mansion fled, say, what distemper gave thee to the dead? Has life a fair lamp declined by slow decay, or swift expired in a sudden blaze? Say if my sire, good old Laertes, lives, if yet Telemachus, my son, survives. Say, by his rule is my dominion awed, or crushed by traitors with an iron rod? Say, if my spouse maintains her royal trust, though tempted, chaste, and obstinately just? Or if no more her absent lord she wails, but the false woman o'er the wife prevails? Thus I, and thus the parent shade returns. Thee, ever thee, thy faithful consort mourns, whether the night descends or the day prevails. Thee, she by night, and thee by day bewails. Thee, in Telemachus, thy realm obeys, in sacred globes celestial rites he pays, and shares the banquet in superior state, graced with such honor as becomes the great. Thy sire in solitude foments his care. The court is joyless, for thou art not there. No costly carpets raise his hoary head, no rich embroidery shines to grace his bed. Even when keen winter freezes in the skies, ranked with his slaves on earth the monarch lies. Deep are his sighs, his visage pale, his dress the garb of woe and habit of distress. And when autumn takes his annual round, the leafy honors scattered on the ground, regardless of his years, abroad he lies, his bed the leaves, his canopy the skies, thus cares on cares his painful days consume, and bow his age with sorrows to the tomb. For thee, my son, I wept my life away, for thee, though hell an eternal dungeon stray, nor came my fate by lingering pains and slow, nor bent the silver-shafted queen her bow, no dire disease bereaved me of my breath, and names of man, thou, my son, wert my disease and death. Unkindly with my love my son conspired, for these I lived, for absent thee expired. Thrice in my arms I strove her shade to bind, thrice through my arms she slipped like empty wind, or dreams the vain illusions of the mind. Wild with despair I shed a copious tide of flowing tears, and thus with sighs replied, fliest thou, love's shade, while I thus fondly mourn, turn to my arms, to my embraces turn. Is it, ye powers that smile at human harms, too great a bliss to weep within her arms? Or hast hell's queen an empty image sent, that wretched I may in my joys lament? O son of woe, the pensive shade rejoined, O most inured to grief of all mankind, 'tis not the queen of hell who thee deceives. All are such, when life the body leaves, no more the substance of this melon remains, nor bounds the blood along the purple veins. These the funeral flames in atoms bear, to wander with the wind in empty air, while the impressive soul reluctant flies, like the vain dreams, to the infernal skies. But from the dark dominion speed the way, and climb the steep ascent to upper day. To thy chaste bride the wondrous story tell, the woes, the horrors, the laws of hell. Thus, while she spoke, a swarmed hell's empress brings daughters and wives of heroes and of kings. Thick and more thick they gather round the blood. Ghost thronged on ghost in dire assembly stood. Dauntless my sword I seized the airy crew. Swift as it flashed along the gloom withdrew. Then shade to shade in mutual form succeeds. Her race recounts their illustrious deeds. Ptero began, whom great Salmaeus bred, the royal partner of famed Critheus bed, the fair Epeneus, from fruitful urns he pours his watery store, the virgin burns, smooth flows the gentle stream from wanton pride, and in soft mazes roils a silver tide, and on his banks the maid enamored roves. The monarch of the deep beholds and loves, here in Ephinius' form and borrowed charms, the amorous god descends into her arms. Around a spacious arc of waves he throws, and high in air the liquid mountain rose. Thus, in surrounding floods concealed, he proves the pleasing transport and completes his loves. Thus, softly sighing, he the fair addressed, and as he spoke, her tender hand he pressed. Hail, happy nymph! No vulgar birth are owed to the prolific raptures of a god. Lo, when nine times the moon renews her horn, two brother heroes shall from thee be born, and elder and early care the future worthless claim to point them to the arduous path of fame. Not in thy breast the important truth conceal, how dare the secret of a god reveal? For know, though Neptune viewst, and at my nod the earth trembles and the waves confess their god. And I will leave chapter 11 of the Iliad there.
Wow.
How was that, my friend?
Ominous story.
Yeah. So that wonderful. It's just so interesting that we, through stories, we have an idea of what people believed thousands of years ago.
Absolutely.
You know, and of course, death is such a big one. As we talked about last week, I just was in Europe for 3 weeks, and I was visiting one of my sons. And as we were walking through Paris, he said, "So, what do you believe about souls?" And I laughed, and I here's our philosophical, you know, discussion in the middle of Paris, but you know, that whole idea of, well, what happens and what is a soul and where do we get it from? And do we make it up to to have a better idea about what happens after we die? Or is there something that lasts, you know? And also, through the years, through the thousands of years since this story was written, because Homer, of course, wrote this in, like, was it 1500 BC, someplace way back then?
Right, right.
You know? So, I mean, this is 3,500 years ago, and people's ideas about death and what lasts and where you go afterwards, it's the grand mystery of our life, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I had an interesting experience with a gentleman named Homer. I had I was driving across the southwestern desert, and I picked up a hitchhiker. And he got into the van we were in, and this van was decked out in full spiritual hippie mode. There were God's eyes, guru pictures, feathers, beads. And he was a young man with a pair of overalls, only hooked on one side, no shirt, clearly a country boy. And he took a look around this van, and he said, "My God, what's all this?" And I thought I could give him a lengthy explanation that we're spiritual seekers, and these are all tokens of our devotion. These are all symbols of our work toward enlightenment. But then I thought, he doesn't want to hear that. He wants a nice, simple, two-word explanation. So I said, "We're magicians." I figured that was adequate. And he took that, and he sat back. And I said, "By the way, I'm Peter Purple, and this is my wife, Linda. What's your name?" And he said, "Well, I got a really dumb name. You don't want to know my name." I said, "Brother, listen, there's no problem. You know, today you can make up any old name you want. Be whatever you want. What do you want to be?" And he goes, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, you can call yourself anything." I said, "We've known mountains. We've known forests. We've known brooks. We've had friends named Rainbow. We have a friend named Om Susanna. I mean, what do you want to be? Be whatever you want to be. No problem." And he goes, "Well, I got a dumb name." You know, clearly we were not connecting. And I had a flash. I had one of those moments of light, and I said, "You know, brother, I bet that if you tell me your name, I can tell you something about that name that you don't know that'll be so amazing that you will understand that you have a really awesome name." He goes, no, I got a dumb name." I said, "No, I understand you think you have a dumb name. Just tell me what your name is. I think I can tell you something amazing about it." Meanwhile, my wife looks over at me like, you're really something. You're going out on a limb here, you know? Because we're driving in the middle of the desert. So I said, "So what's your name?" He said, "Well, my name's Homer." I said, Homer, what an awesome name. And he goes, no, it's a dumb name." Now, this is way before The Simpsons ever came along.
Right.
I said, "My friend Homer, I said, have you ever heard of a guy named Ulysses?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah, now that was a guy, man. He was like some kind of ancient Greek guy, like some kind of warrior." I said, "This guy, this warrior that you know about, lived 3,000 years ago." And he goes, "Yeah?" And I thought, okay, I got to put this in a frame of reference. I said, "Older than the Bible, okay? Older than anything that happened in the Bible, this thing happened. This guy wrote a story about a famous warrior." And he goes, "What guy wrote a story about this warrior?" I said, "A guy named Homer. And it was such a great story that we still tell it 3,000 years later." And he went, "Well, damn. Nobody ever told me that."
How wonderful.
My wife looked at me and went, "Yeah, you got that one. Okay."
You pulled that one out of your hat, Mr. Magician.
Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Thank you, Kat. Thank you, Lil.
Thank you. Thank you, Lantern. Next week, since we're still in Scorpio, we will probably be telling more interesting tales about the life and death as we go into the dark part of the year. And next week, are we going to have another storyteller on?
I think so. Okay. I think it's the least we can do.
I think so, too. So, Lil, thank you so much for joining us tonight with your wonderful stories.
Oh, it's been my pleasure these past few weeks. Thank you very much for allowing me to join you.
Okay, and come back again soon.
Certainly will.
Thank you, Kat. As always, a delight.
Thank you, Lantern. And so, Mary Meet and Mary Part.
And Mary Meet Again.
And Mary Meet Again. Until next week at the Bard's Grove.
Okie dokie. See you next week, folks.
Oh.